13. This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. I'm coming to you from the suburbs of Chicago. Thanks for joining me today on RBN, for people who can handle the truth. RBN's website is republicbroadcasting.org. To see the guest lineup and relevant links for this program, please visit spingola.com. Click on the radio schedule button, then the appropriate month. There's also a link on my website to ZCF's book, and it is entitled Masters of Deception, and that is, of course, at spingola.com. During the program, email your questions or comments to spingola1@yahoo.com. Remember that I do not access my other email address during the program, so if you ask questions at that email address, I will not see them until after the program. Join others in the chat room by clicking on the chat room button on my website, spingola.com, or by going to spingola.chatango.com. We will take calls in the second hour after we open the phone lines at 800-313-9443. My guest today is Rodney Martin. He is the director of Worldview Foundations. That website is WV as in Victor, WVFoundations.org. Rodney, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Deanna. Thank you for having me on this morning.
Well, thank you for joining me. I know it's earlier there in California, and anyway, I'm glad that you. It's not that early. It's 9 o'clock.
No, it's 9 a.m. sharp, and I've been up for a little while. I had a long drive the last few days, but I'm looking forward to the topic this morning. This is going to be fun.
Oh, exactly. Well, it's always very enjoyable to have you on, and you always select a good topic that is relevant to what's going on now. And I always maintain that it's imperative to know our history before we can know what is going on today. Now, I did have a note from a friend, a listener today, and he suggests that rather than bringing up the Jews and why Hitler expelled them from Germany, why not have somebody come on who is familiar with the present-day Jewish tactics in Europe, and instead of going over, you know, what the NSDAP did and, you know, some of this other stuff that he feels is not relevant. How do you feel about that?
Well, actually, the playbook is the same. And, you know, that is a valid point. And there is a debate going on in the truth community. And I hear about it all the time. It says, let's just step over all of this stuff in history, and let's just forget about our history. Here's the issue. What happened in the, and I like to really talk about the Weimar Republic and the period, you know, in the National Socialist period. And actually, I go back even before we haven't done a show on this. I'd like to do a show with you, Deanna, on what happened in Imperial Germany, what the Jews did to the Kaiser, and what they did in Imperial Germany. Because I even studied that period. I've done a lot of research in that period as well. But here's the problem. What's happening in Europe today, they're just doing the same. They do, you know, they really don't, you know, leopard doesn't change its spots. It's the same playbook.
Yeah, very creative.
No, and of course that speaks horribly to us because we keep falling for it.
Exactly.
As my wife, she says, you know, it sounds like, you know, these people are doing the same thing over and over throughout history. You know, why don't, you know, there's that old saying, he that does not learn from his history is destined to repeat itself. Well, that's absolutely true. I couldn't agree with that saying more. So, you know, and I keep drawing the parallel of Weimar because it is absolutely parallel.
Exactly. All righty. We do need to take a quick 3-minute break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Welcome back. This is Deanna. And our guest today is Rodney Martin. He is the director of Worldview Foundations, whose website is wvfoundations.org. All righty. So we were talking about why it's important, and you were talking about why it's important to study history. And you were talking about the Weimar Republic, and even before, which I've covered somewhat in my second book, talking about some of the things that went on, and the Jewish monopolies that existed in Germany, and as early as 1870.
Well, yes, this is, you know, the Jews have been at the war, and I've said that, you know, made this comment on some other shows. on your shows, Deanna, that the Jews have had their, you know, two countries in their in their bullseyes for a long time, and one was Russia and the other was Germany for two very, you know, different reasons. Russia for its vast, you know, resources and size, and Germany for its, you know, innovativeness, for its technical know-how, for its, you know, for its brain. Basically, I always said Germany for its brains and Russia for its brawn. And boy, they, you know, they took down the Tsar. You know, they worked for, you know, for years to take down the Tsar. And then they went through a horrendous, you know, the ethnic cleansing, the Christian cleansing they engaged in Russia. You don't hear about it. You don't hear about that Holocaust. But they got Russia with the Bolshevik revolution by creating this thing called communism, Marxism. And then they went right to work going after Germany. You know, they got the brawn in Russia. Then they went after, they were going after the brain. They had this, you know, they, you know, one of the, you know, they have statues of this female communist Marxist, Rosa Luxemburg. You know, they have statues of her in Berlin. It's kind of interesting that they take down all of the nationalist statues and memorials in Germany, but they keep all the communist statues and the Soviet war memorials, that we've talked about that before. But they, you know, going back to the, you know, 1800s, they've had this. They've, you know, they went after Russia, they went after Germany, and they, you know, they began to undermine the imperial system in both Russia and in Germany. And of course, World War One. We talked about it, I believe, on the last show, where you had this Jew that was in charge of the war materials and war production, and concurrently with the Balfour Declaration by Britain. All of a sudden, there was no more war materials at a critical year, you know, the end of 1917, 1918, when basically Germany had beaten Russia, had knocked Russia out of the war, was shifting its troops to the west, was marching on Paris, and all of a sudden, what we talked about, the stab in the back. And the stab in the back was absolutely real. And the stab in the back came from the Jews and the Marxists, which are one and the same, in Germany. And so when you had Ludendorff and Hindenburg and the, you know, imperial, the general staff talking about, you know, we didn't lose this war militarily, we were stabbed in the back at home, they were absolutely correct, and they knew about it. And the Kaiser, for years in exile in Holland, would talk about, you know, resented what the Jews had done to him and done to his country, because they knew it. They knew exactly what had happened. All of a sudden, there was no materials for his troops, you know, marching into France. He knew it. It didn't matter that the Americans were arriving. He was shifting all of those troops from the Eastern Front to the West, and they were going to win that war.
Right. Actually, they didn't really even invade Germany in World War One.
No, there was no.
It was totally right. Something that happened with the politicians and certain politicians in Berlin, in Germany, and it was a travesty.
Yeah, then you had all of these what the National Socialists and the Nationalists, the German, would call the November Criminals, that proclaimed this, you know, this republic, you know, and then went to Versailles and, you know, signed this treaty, and of course the rest is history. They created this Weimar Republic and then began to transform German culture. I mean, they went after there again. They went after Germany, and they almost had it. They almost had it and had not been for the National Socialists. And, you know, they almost had Europe in general. I mean, you know, Stalin, we can conjecture, you know, they were going to get Spain. There would have been a Soviet satellite. The first Soviet satellite country in Spain, that was basically a communist satellite, had the Italians and the Germans not intervened in Spain. I mean, you have President Roosevelt writing personal checks to the communists.
Right. Wilson did the same thing.
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. I mean, here you had a clear situation where you had communists that were butchering Catholic priests and nuns. You had a communist state in, you know, in Western Europe. And you had a clear situation where the battle lines are drawn, and you had Western nations sympathetic to the communists, and you had National Socialist Germany providing a battleship Deutschland, as well as volunteers, you know, Luftwaffe providing support to General Franco, who was actually down in Spanish Morocco, who had to invade his own country to liberate it from communism. And there was a clear example of, you know, who were the true defenders of Western Christian civilization in Europe and the bulwark against communism. Who originally recognized the axis of evil? It certainly wasn't the United States and the Jews in London and New York. You know, it was the United States and Britain were on the wrong side of history. They were tools by international Jewry. And we paid a horrible price. The peoples of Eastern Europe have paid a horrible price post-1945, and even today, just because, you know, supposedly communism has fallen in the Soviet Union, they just have a new version. They just have a new version. Putin is nothing to write home about by any means.
Well, of course not. Absolutely not. Some of the stuff that he's done recently and some things I've talked about on this program, he definitely is not on the right side. And just given the situation that happened in 1990, just because they opened some archives and let a few facts out and that kind of thing, does not mean that that Russia is now all of a sudden this wonderful capitalist community. I mean, they just they're still monopolies over there. They're still owned by the cabal, the criminal cabal, and Putin is quite friendly with the rabbis. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I just think that they just formed what's considered an overtly Judeo sort of Marxism. You have, and we're going to talk about that on our topic today, the difference between National Socialism and Marxism of the left. But you have situations when that's a clear distinction. I'll mention it real briefly because it's a clear point. I interviewed and spoke on two Worldview Foundations, a gentleman who's leading an effort in what is now called Kaliningrad, one of the last major cities is still named after a communist butcher. It used to be Konigsberg, East Prussia, and he's leading an effort to rename Kaliningrad back to Konigsberg. And he's talking about what Putin is doing and the Russians are doing in what it should be called Konigsberg. They're importing all of these, what you would call South Asian Muslims into what should be Konigsberg, Kaliningrad, and basically changing the demographic of basically a European city. And of course, they're basically doing to Konigsberg or Kaliningrad what is happening in the United States with the Hispanics. You know, it's displacing, you know, Russians in Konigsberg, taking jobs, and it's basically ethnically changing that city. And there is, that's a Putin policy, importing all of these South Asian from the stan, what you would call like, you know, the stans, you know, Kazakhstan, you know, which borders Russia. All of these Muslims into Kaliningrad, which used to be Konigsberg. That's some of the policies of Putin, which is very Marxist, very Jewish.
And
that's a clear difference between National Socialism and Marxism of the left, Deanna, and we're going to talk about that during the show. Putin is not something to write home about. I know when he first came to power during his first tenure, a lot of nationalists, he boondoggled a lot of nationalists, and I was never a fan of Mr. Putin. I always recognized him as being a Soviet, just, you know, in a nicer suit, and someone that was clearly in the back pocket of the rabbis. He never, you know, he never declines a meeting with the rabbis over there. He passed some of the most draconian anti-nationalist laws to essentially say that you cannot go back and revise the history of World War II in Russia or the former Soviet Union. So he is definitely very kosher, very Marxist, and he's still keep in mind, he was a KGB agent.
Absolutely.
And he was assigned to East Germany. He did all the dirty work for the Soviets and the East Germans repressing the Germans. So, you know, I have no use for him.
I agree totally. Absolutely.
Anyway, this show, as we talk about, and that's the topic we talked about, Deanna, is the difference. Because, and I think this show was prompted by a discussion we had on one of my last appearances. We had a caller, and a very good caller. I've had some subsequent email conversations with the caller talking about socialism is socialism is socialism because National Socialism has that name. And I received a lot of emails, Deanna, about, you know, the term National Socialism that's in there. And I think this show, Deanna, you know, let the callers call in. And I think because this question is going to be, this show is going to have to be one that's going to have to be driven primarily. I have a lot of material, but also I really want to hear from callers, did National Socialism do this or did they not do this? Because this is really going to be, a participatory type of a show as well, because there was a lot of misinformation and what I'm going to, you know, talk about during the show, going back to the 1930s, there was a concerted effort by the American media to link National Socialism and Soviet communism going back to the 1930s, back to, you know, Time magazine back in 1938 when they put Adolf Hitler as Man of the Year. of course, that was, you know, they was always this, you know, kind of cheeky effort. And, of course, we know, all know who the major American media was dominated by, even going back that far. And even in the British media, there was a concerted effort to distort Hitler's speeches and to say that he had made statements that he absolutely did not, or to take them out of context. And I'm going to talk about that today as well. But we all know what Marxism and socialism of the left is. I don't think I have to belabor that issue, but we do know. We got the music coming up, so we'll pick it up on the other end.
All righty. Be right back in 3 minutes. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Rodney Martin. He is the director of Worldview Foundations, and that website is wvfoundations.org. And we were talking about the differences between socialism, or you're going to talk about the differences between socialism and national socialism. And we do welcome calls at 800-313-9443. Let's wait until the second hour to take calls, okay?
Hitler said, as opposed to what the American, and I'm going to give a couple examples of what the British and American media said going back, and how they created this absolute bastardization of linking the two. And of course, then when, of course, you had Hitler launched a preemptive strike against the Soviet Union, that kind of put them into a schizophrenic frenzy, because they didn't know what to think. Because for, you know, a good, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, American and British media had engaged in this campaign of saying that the two were identical. And in some cases, the media had said that National Socialism was based off of Marxism, which was kind of interesting. They'd even coined a term, you know, back in 1940 called Commu-Nazi. I even looked that up. I had seen that back in my university days and laughed about that. And of course, you have people like Alex Jones and Glenn Beck running around linking communism and national socialism. It just goes to show you how unlettered and uneducated they are. But
exactly.
Let's look at what Hitler said. Now, this was made. This is a speech. This is just three objectives. Yeah, I'm not going to read the whole speech, Deanna. But on May 17th, 1933, now Hitler had been appointed chancellor in accordance with the Weimar Constitution by President von Hindenburg on January 30th. So February, March, April, May. So 4 months after he assumed the chancellorship, Hitler goes to the Reichstag and he says, these are the three main objectives of National Socialism. I mean, these are his words. You can look up, you can go. In fact, I believe I emailed you a link of archived documents, original archived documents that are scanned. Deanna, I think I sent you that link, and it's posted on my website as well. This speech is in that archived document. And so Hitler says on May 17, 1933 in the Reichstag, the three main objectives of National Socialism is, number one, the first and foremost, number one, prevent a threatened communist revolution. Number one. So right away, National Socialism is against communism. Now, if you just stop for just a minute and think, well, wait a minute. If National Socialism is based off of Marxism and communism, but they're one, or they're two peas in the same pot, then why would, you know, number one be to stop a communist revolution? We'll just get into it a little bit. Then it says in the same number one, and to build up a nation state that shall unite the interests of all the different classes and to maintain the idea of property as the basis of culture. That's a powerful statement, because that's completely polar opposite of socialism and Marxism, because you don't have that under socialism and Marxism. The idea of property, of you owning your own property in socialism and Marxism, they don't like that at all. It's collectivization under socialism and Marxism. They don't like that concept. That's a foreign concept to them. Number two, solve the most difficult social problems by bringing back millions of our unfortunate unemployed into productive work. It's another issue that I think runs conflict to socialism and Marxism, because their idea is the welfare state, whereas National Socialism is predicated on work, and we'll get into that a little bit later. And number three, establish authoritarian government, authoritative, not authoritarian, I misspoke there, authoritarian is more communist, authoritative government, supported by the will and confidence of the nation, which shall make our great people a partner to the other states of the world. Now, there you have Hitler saying that he's going to make the government stronger, but it's going to be supported by the will and confidence of the nation. And he's going to restore it to its proper place in the world.
Now, Rodney, you have on your homepage, you have on the left-hand side, you have several links. And I would expect that the document that you're reading from, it would be found in the archives, but I don't find it there.
That speech is probably in the link. I pulled that particular speech off of the link site that I sent you in the original archive documents. It was published in the Gazette, of all the speeches that were given. So you'll probably have to go to the links to get that, but I will post immediately after the show, I will post that.
Okay.
I will post that as a separate entity. I will post it under the show so everybody can get it. But that was a speech on May 17th, 1933. That's Hitler speaking in the Reichstag. And that is him saying specifically what the three objectives of National Socialism would be. Now, we can go back into number one. He says, prevent the threatened communist revolution to build up a nation state which shall unite the interests of the different classes and to maintain the idea of property as the basis of culture. That is completely foreign to what was taking place, you know, just east of Germany over in the Soviet Union, which everybody was looking at as the, quote, workers' paradise. Workers of the world unite. Now, that leads me to another concept. National Socialism was not... Oh, we've got the music break. Pick it up.
We'll be right back in 3 minutes. Deanna, and our guest today is Rodney Martin. He is the director of Worldview Foundations, and that website is wvfoundations.org. All righty, carry on.
Deanna, there is some great conversations taking place in the chat room, and they just brought up the Volkswagen. I'm going to touch on that as we talk about trade unions and what happened to them under National Socialism. There's a great, very great thread. Line of discussion going on about the Volkswagen. I'm going to touch on that real briefly, but let's go on and we talk about this issue of, you know, the term socialism and National Socialism that was very much distorted. In 1938, a British newspaper, Sunday Express, interviewed Hitler, actually, and believe it or not, Hitler gave a lot of media interviews from the foreign press, and he was asked specifically this question, and this is a direct quote from that interview. Socialist, I define from the word social, meaning in the main social equity. A socialist is one who serves the common good without giving up his individuality or personality or the product of his personal efficiency. Now, that's a critical point. We'll talk about that after I finish reading the whole quote. Our adopted term, meaning the NSDAP, the German term socialist, has nothing to do with Marxian socialism. Marxism is anti-property. True socialism is not. Marxism places no value on the individual or individual effort or efficiency. True socialism values the individual and encourages him in individual efficiency, at the same time holding that his interests as an individual must be in consonance with those of the community. All great inventions, discoveries, achievements were first the product of an individual brain. It is not charged against me that I am against property, that I am an atheist. Both charges are false. Now, there he knocks out two issues at the same time. First, he knocks out the issue that he's an atheist, number one. And number two, he clearly defines. I mean, that was an excellent interview. And of course, that interview is buried. You really have to go digging to find that particular interview find that, you just don't find that. You don't find that in a lot of these, what I call agenda-driven historians. clearly he's talking about the fact that, and I'll use a simple, here's a simple comparison. The famous AK-47 rifle, the Kalashnikov. First of all, it's a knockoff of the German Sturmgewehr. Kalashnikov saw the famous German Sturmgewehr, which loosely translated means assault rifle. Beautiful weapon. They're very rare. I had an opportunity to own one one time, and I didn't take up the opportunity. I should have. But anyway, he took that and he modified it and made it into what is called the AK-47. But under Soviet communism, under Marxism, that wasn't his. That way, he enjoyed no benefit of that from basically making the modifications and recrafting it and changing that. That belonged to everything belonged to the state. Period. All of the great inventions and designs, anything that was designed and built in the Soviet or the Marxist system, the individual didn't partake in any of the fruits of his or her endeavor. That is a clear distinction between what took place in National Socialist Germany. Under here's Hitler saying that under National Socialism, the individual does count. The individual, you know, the individual does take part in his or her achievements. However, you do not take precedence over the larger national community. And I think that's a good thing. Let's look at what's happened in the United States, where we have devolved into a country where it's all me. And really, you know, people will say, I'm an American. They'll beat their chest and say, I'm an American. But what is that? You ask them what that really means. And they say, well, it means I can go out and just, you know, do whatever I want, or it's, you know, I want to get rich, or I want to, everything's about the individual, which is, there's nothing wrong with that, I guess. However, mindless materialism and self-aggrandizement and such, that's not what Hitler was talking about. He was talking about, yes, you will have private property, you will. In fact, people got rich, and I'm going to talk about this a little bit later. People got very rich in National Socialism. There was a free market under National Socialist Germany. There were corporate profits. There were bonuses paid in German under German corporations, huge bonuses as early as 1934, because the economy just started taking off under National Socialists a lot quicker than actually even the National Socialist government thought that it would. Unemployment went from 4.8 million, dropped from 4.8 million in 1934 to 2.2 million in 1933. Was it about 4.8 million down to 2.2 million in 1934? It just took off. The economy took off. Corporate profits started rising. Corporate bonuses to a corporate executive's rate. I mean, this was it. It was a free market economy. It wasn't this hyper plutocratic Judeo economy like what we see. You know, this horrible abomination in the United States and in London. It wasn't that type of an economy, but it wasn't. Nor was it this amalgamation, this mess under Marxism, where it is absolute state control of everything from essentially bread, you know, production of bread to agriculture to everything else. Matter of fact, it was acclaimed early on in the 1930s in the American media that the National Socialists had nationalized the agriculture in Germany. That's not
which
true.
Which is totally ridiculous. In fact, it was academics here in this country that went over to communist Russia and helped them develop their communal living, helped them to develop the collectivized farming over there. Well, and they were really doing it here at the very same time, which led to the Dust Bowl and the Depression and a whole bunch of other things.
You know, I got a news flash for all of the conservative Republicans. Your heroes, the Koch brothers, their daddy made his first fortune off of working for Joseph Stalin.
Yeah.
And people don't realize that. But the conservative fundamentalist Koch brothers, their daddy made his fortune working for Joseph Stalin. Now, you know, I actually think that there is a moral consequence. I think you should decline where you take your money from. And I would not take money from communists, from Jews, from any other, you know, filthy organizations like that. But that's where the Koch brothers' fortune derives from Joseph Stalin. So, you know, think about that, conservative Republicans, every time you chant about all the good work the Koch brothers are doing. So that's Uncle Joe's money.
Right.
Anyway, Moving on, Hitler made some other additional statements as to what National Socialism was and was not. Let's go back early on. He says, origins of the National Socialist title. This is just a little nostalgia that I thought was good to pull up my notes here. He says, I had at the time in 1918 discovered two ideals which it seemed could unquestionably inspire men and bring them. Now, keep in mind, he said by 1918, could unquestionably inspire men and bring them under their spell. The socialist and the nationalist ideals. For these two ideals, men at that time were ready, if necessary, even to die. If for an ideal can so inspire a man that he is prepared to give his life for it, then it holds within a mighty and kindling force. And I was then resolved to take these two ideals and fuse them into a single whole. If I succeeded in that, then the nation might be saved. If not, the nation would be more and more tear itself into pieces and would finally go down to the impotence and ruin. Now, that was a speech he gave also in 1938 to Sudeten Germans on December 2nd, 1938. Now, you have him basically explaining to the Sudeten Germans on December 2nd, 1938, the origins, saying, this is how I came up. I basically fused the two concepts, nationalism and socialism. Then you have him explaining to the prior quote, which I gave to the Sunday Express, which was late towards the end of the month. You have speaking to the Sudeten Germans on December 2nd, 1938. Then about 3 weeks later on December 28th, after Christmas, 1938, explaining to the Sunday Express exactly what socialism means. So there's no ambiguity there. There's no confusion there. He's explaining exactly what national socialism, what socialism means under national socialism, what German socialism is. He's basically saying it preserves property, it preserves the individual, it preserves the work and merit and ideas and intellectual property of the individual. That is not the property of the state, but it also says the overall good of the national community is not going to be exploited at the expense of, say, what we've had in the United States. And let's give an example of that. In the United States, contrary to a lot of popular, there's a whole lot of what I would call Marxist socialism. You had these plutocratic Judeo-corporations running around screaming against and railing against socialism and saying, we have a right to free enterprise and business and profits and all that, and they basically privatized their profits while basically building their profits up off of a lot of government grants and government research and development. And then after they misused and mismanaged, and we talked about a little about this because the NSDAP opposed this and they talked about it in their 1928 economic plan, when they crashed and burned because of poor management, they immediately demanded nationalization of their losses. That's socialism, Deanna. They immediately demanded taxpayers.
And we see it going on now with all the bailouts and all the other nonsense.
Now, incidentally, National Socialists, and we covered this when we covered the 1928 economic plan, the National Socialists, and I have a copy of the economic plan, which I sent, and that is posted on my website, they actually exposed that in 1928. They talked about the banks making huge profits, Judeo banks, and then when they crashed, demanding German taxpayers cover their losses. And they opposed that in 1928, and they additionally opposed that throughout their government, and we see that to this day. So when we hear people screaming, particularly these corporate elites, Judeo and plutocratic corporate elites, screaming against anything socialistic, but when they have basically also they're at the public trough, getting great federal grants and getting subsidies for research and development of their product, and not repaying the taxpayers for those grants and research and development funds that they got from the taxpayers, and then keeping all the profits. And then when they crash and burn because they have paid themselves excessive bonuses and salaries and mismanaged their companies, and then demand a bailout, that's not even socialism, Deanna. That's communism.
Right.
Let's just call it what it is. That is corporate communism. That is alive and well in the United States of America. So when these right-wing conservatives stand up and say, oh, Nazis are communists, actually, no. Look in the mirror before you throw a rock out your broken window.
Right.
So anyway, I wanted to compare and throw those two that speech in 1938 to the Sudeten Germans, and then that interview to the Sunday Express in 1938, because I think that clearly defines the NSDAP's form of socialism and the German form of socialism. I think that really, really spells it out very clearly and concisely. Let's talk about early on where this, I say it's confusion, I think it's done purposely, but you have this situation where Americans purposely through the media had linked, you know, National Socialism and fascist and communist ideologies, because they would link all that through what I would call generalizations and emotionally charged oversimplifications and such. A lot of that was done in the media. And a big one, a huge one, was done because the there was some quotes that were misrepresented in the 1938 Time magazine article that said, quote, the Nazi credo, when keep in mind Nazi is a derogatory term, the proper term is National Socialist. The individual belongs to the state, and that also applies to business. And some have been confiscated outright, and others that amounts to a capital tax has been levied. And I'm reading this from a scan of the Time magazine article that I pulled off of Time magazine's website. Profits have been strictly controlled. Increased governmental control and interference in business is deduced from the fact that 80% of all building and 50% of all industrial orders in Germany originated last year from the government. Here's the problem. That's all false. Right. If you look at that, is absolutely all false. It's completely. The fact is, the National Socialists, they didn't collectivize agriculture at all. Back in their 1928 economic plan, which we discussed in detail on your show, they actually proposed and passed legislation to preserve individually owned family farms. They opposed what we would call the massive agribusinesses like ConAgra and such. They opposed that. But they actually laws to preserve private ownership of family farms. In fact, they encouraged rural, what we would call rural development today. They encouraged that. They actually did not like the Jewish policy of herding people into cities. They actually opposed that at all. So, I mean, there is an actual 1938, that while Time magazine named Hitler Man of the Year, it was an effort to suck people into an anti-national socialist article. To go a step further, these other statements were made in the article. Again, this is 1938. They, the National Socialists actually, Deanna, they lowered taxes on businesses because they wanted to increase productivity. They wanted to increase hiring and production, which accounts for the fact that you have an unemployment figure of about 5 million, 4.8 million in 1933. It drops to 2.2 million just a year later, 12 months later, 1934. So the stats just, I mean, the statistics, the numbers never lie. You know, that's why I'm a digressive. That's why the Holocaust has proven to be such a fraud. Numbers just don't add up. So you have they're talking about the excessive taxes and government control of businesses. When you actually look at what was taking place, it's clearly not communist. It's clearly not Marxist. It's clearly a free enterprise, pro-business, pro-free enterprise, but it's basically is in line with everything they said in 1928, geared towards a full employment economy, something that even Roosevelt wasn't even doing, because Roosevelt was schizophrenic. He was so, you know, he was talking about getting people back to work, all of his government programs. At the same time, he was regulation and Marxist happy and socialist happy, putting all these other things in place. That by, you know, 1939, the country was no better off than when he taken office in 1933.
It was much worse.
Yes, absolutely. That's why he was itching to get into war.
Right.
In fact, you know, then you have the big lie that says that the National Socialists, that they had built their economy up on a war footing. Well, we're going to show that wasn't true either.
Absolutely false. We are going to a quick break. We'll be right back in 3 minutes.
Very good.
Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today is Rodney Martin. He is the director of Worldview Foundations. His website is wvfoundations.org. All righty. And we will take calls in the next hour after the first break. So think up your questions and get ready to call in.
And I was just coming to it. It asked me, how would National Socialists respond to the Catholic distributive theory and social theory? Well, actually, let's talk about that, because I was coming to that before the break. The fact is, and it relates to agriculture and lands and such, the fact is the National Socialists opposed and did not collectivize any lands. And as a matter of fact, they passed specific laws that ensured that family farms, other farms, would remain in private ownership and would not be broken up into small pieces at inheritance. That is far from collectivization, as a matter of fact. And they also passed laws under their, they repealed Weimar laws and passed additional laws once they took power that assured that family estates and small farms were protected. Also, in 19, there was a referendum in 1925 and 1926 that actually did that, that called for that. It was called the exportation referendum as well, and they opposed, Hitler opposed that. So when you come, when the National Socialists had a, you know, had opportunities to act in a real so hardcore socialist manner, they never did. They actually took all opposite positions as far back as 1925. But anyway, if you getting back to their the business side of it, they were consistently, and this is outlined in their 1928 economic plan, which we did talk about on your show, and I'll talk about it. Their economic policy was based on full employment. It was based on the value of work as opposed to the welfare state, which is a hallmark of socialism and Marxism. And
as Basiat talks about in his small book, The Law.
Yeah. And you talk about, you go a step further, you know, when I talk, and I was drawing the contrast early, just their first year, you know, the combination of, you know, the, you know, early on, you know, domestic demand and the end of, you know, foreign competition, and then there was the rising price, says, you know, by the end, indeed, the end of 1934, the and with the unemployment dropping so rapidly, there were, you know, profits, corporate profits, business profits were rising, and the bonuses were being paid as a matter, and the tax revenues going in were beginning to rise. So the criticism that the National Socialists had received for lowering those rates had completely dissipated, because their whole concept was they were not socialists of the left. They were free markets, and they were their whole emphasis was getting all of the Germans back to work. And I think we talked about that number two priority back. We talked about it as we started the show. Hitler's May 17, 1933 Reichstag speech solved the most difficult social programs by bringing back millions of our unfortunate people back to work.
Right. All righty. We're going into our 60-second top of the hour break. We'll be right back after our station ID and a word from our sponsors. Pat, this is the second hour of Spingola Speaks. This is Deanna Spingola. Our guest today is Rodney Martin. He is the director of Worldview Foundations. That website is wvfoundations.org. And Rodney is talking about the differences between socialism and National Socialism, and showing us these comparisons and by examples. And when you look at what is happening in our country today, it's just amazing. And people still think that we live in a capitalist country. It is just amazing. If you look at history and look at things, oh my gosh, we are living in communism, people.
This, you know, and you just hit the nail on the head, Deanna. And I think the greatest source to prove that National Socialism is vastly different than socialism of the left and Marxism. Let's just hear it from one of their great icons, Leon Trotsky, in June of 1933. while he was in exile in Turkey, you know, when Stalin chased him out and Stalin was getting rid of all of his rivals. Trotsky, the one, you know, communists and Marxists, they weren't afraid of capitalism. But when National Socialists were came to power, that bothered them. That really, really bothered them. And so Trotsky penned an essay in June of 1933 called What is National Socialism? And he published it. And he added a postscript to it. Because it was, by the time he finished it, you know, he was getting ready to go to print. It was coming up on the first anniversary of the National Socialists coming to power in Germany. But throughout this essay, and I will PDF this, and as I said earlier in the chat room, I will post on my radio page on my website. I'm going to post a new section that says sources, and I'll post PDFs and links
where they can get on your radio page. Okay,
yes, on my radio page. Yes.
Okay. And that's Worldview Radio?
Yes, Worldview Radio. Okay. That's where I'll post it. There, under there, there'll be a new section. It'll start going up today. In fact, my son is working on it right now. Figured that was the easiest point. You'll see, it'll basically, the economic plan will be there. This Trotsky essay. But anyway, in June of 1933, Trotsky, I mean, he just went right to work. He was really concerned about this. And he goes out of his way to talk about how, you know, and he pens it better than I, that National Socialism clearly is not Marxism. It's clearly not communism. And I'm going to highlight some of his, like, it's a very long essay. Trotsky, you know, Neon Leon Trotsky, he always had a lot to say, as every Marxist and communist does. But he goes, you know, his chief complaints are, one, that National Socialism, one, is not international. We've already established that on your show. Two, that it does not control and dominate all the economic spheres of life. It does not control the means of production, sale, does not control the means of property. Thank you. That's what we've been saying from the get-go, that National Socialism is not does not dominate all the spheres of economic life in the nation. And then he starts talking about the overt nationalism. You know, the fact that, you know, communism, Marxism, workers of the world unite, you know. What has happened in the United States and what happened in Weimar is a complete, and keep in mind, Trotsky was a Jew, and he mentions, you know, talks about this fact that Marxism and communism brings all of the various peoples together. Well, that is something that is specifically rejected by National Socialism. And keep in mind, National Socialist, Hitler said National Socialism is not for export. It was something unique to Germany, and I can understand why, looking at some of the various attempts at National Socialism in the United States and elsewhere. We're going to break. I will
yes. But it has worked. It has worked in some places recently, but then the U.S. military went in and clobbered them. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna. And our guest today is Rodney Martin. We will take your calls at 800-313-9443. Rodney's website is wvfoundations.org. And just before the break, you'd mentioned that National Socialism was not for export. But we have had other countries recently who have attempted to initiate, or actually they've been successful at it, have a socialistic kind of a program, national socialism, in their countries. And I'm thinking about Libya and Iraq. Actually, Iraq had national socialism, or a form of it.
The same for Libya was a good example. If you read, it was Gaddafi, I believe, his Green Book. The Green Book is what he had written. You see a lot of elements of national socialism there. Saddam Hussein definitely was pursuing a national socialist type of program. And here, let me finish up with Trotsky's 1933. There's an example. Anybody that wants to make a statement that National Socialism is the same as Marxist socialism and socialism on the left, here's Trotsky, you know, just absolutely railing that, you know, National Socialism, you know, doesn't control the means of production. But then he finishes up and talks about, he gets into the point that it doesn't, you know, it doesn't include all of the various, you know, peoples. And he's hitting on the fact that National Socialism was a folkish, a national community, as they would say, a way of life, that's something that has always bothered the Jews. The fact that it was something broader than just a simple political and economic theory. It was something that you lived. It was part of the culture. It was part of economics. It was politics. It was a worldview. It's the word I was trying to remember. It was a worldview, and that drove Trotsky and his fellow Jews absolutely bonkers, because it was for Germans, it was for the people, it was for the folk, and it called for the expulsion of these Judaic foreign influences, and particularly the international bankers who were controlled by Jews, and it returned Germany to Germans. It returned the nation. It put a big importance on the nation state, which Marxism and communism and leftism marginalizes. It absolutely
marginalizes. They were international too.
Absolutely. Right. And this is where we have to really distinguish the difference between national socialism and socialism of the left and Marxism. Marxists and leftists absolutely hate nationalists. They want to get rid of nation states, and they want to create this multicultural type of things that, you know, race doesn't matter, because if race doesn't matter, nations doesn't matter, and we're all citizens of the world, with the exception of one citizen and one race and one nation, and that is the Jews. Israel certainly doesn't consider themselves citizens of the world. They consider themselves, in fact, they just recently legally declared themselves the Jewish state. They don't allow mass immigration of non-Jews. They don't allow. They actually, while their tribe are over in every other nation, especially white European Christian nations, calling for, you know, the forced multicultural policies and such. So that is something that Trotsky just actually zeroed in on in this 1933 essay, the fact that National Socialists, and he used all of the code words. He called them imperialists, every Marxist code word imaginable. At the time, keep in mind, when you're reading a speech or an essay from 1933, 1934, you have to read it into the context of the time and what those words meant and how they applied at the time. And here is Trotsky basically calling National Socialists imperialists, and he's bringing up their anti-Semitism because he himself was a Jew himself. And he's just absolutely leveling all of these charges against them, and basically making the case that no, you know, they're not real socialists at all. Well, no, they're not Marxist socialists at all. They're nationalists, and and there is a clear distinction between advocating for a national community of your people and the benefit of your people, while maintaining the integrity and protection of the individual, as opposed to saying that everything is controlled by and for, belongs to the state. And let me give another comparison. There was this recent MSNBC host, Melissa Harris Perry, recently, that had this devastating quote that says, Deanna, that our children are property of the state.
Oh, wasn't that amazing?
Yeah. Now there is a big misconception that said the same thing applied to national socialism. Now, in communist and Marxist country, they believe that. And Mrs. Harris Perry, who herself is a committed leftist, and she's probably a Marxist, she probably won't admit that, but she's a committed leftist. They believe that our children don't belong to us; they belong to the state. Just, you know, you had Bill Clinton's regime shipping that Ilian Gonzalez back off to Cuba and turning him into a young pioneer when he had family here. But there's a classic example there. But they try to say that the same thing with the Hitler Youth and the German Wounded Maiden Girls program was the same thing. It actually was not. National Socialists, you have Hitler giving speech after speech after speech saying that the German family is the cornerstone of the national community, and they actually had pro-family policy. So there was absolutely, going down to social policies, there was a clear difference between National Socialism and Marxist socialism and leftist policies. I'll have this Trotsky speech. It'll be PDF'd. It'll be on there probably by the end of the day as well. The next one I wanted to just give you some additional context was, you know, trade unions are a big one as well. Trade unions are infested. The Marxists have used trade unions for years as a tool and to infiltrate into, in fact, during the Kaiser's years, they used trade unions to undermine the Kaiser's Germany as well. And Hitler recognized that. Trade union policies, and he, in fact, chapter two of Mein Kampf, he talked about that unemployment just devastated the will of the German worker. And he went on and talked about that you'd either have a worker that was unemployed, I'm paraphrasing here, or that he'd be stuck into these leftist Marxist trade unions, and that when he would get to work, they'd put him on the strike because of their Marxist political agenda. He wouldn't be able to work, or then he'd be stuck on this government unemployment type of thing. I mean, he recognized the fact that trade unions, you know, were infested with Marxists, and he talked about himself being on a construction job and hearing these trade union members just talking Marxist, you know, dribble, they were against the nation state, pro-Marxist. And so when the National Socialists came to power, and I've actually heard people that purport to be National Socialists themselves in the United States, or Nationalists, talk about how pro, the National Socialists, they supported trade unions. Well, let me clarify the National Socialists, they disbanded the Weimar trade unions. They got rid of them completely. They were gone, and they created a single labor front.
Right.
And called the DAF. And it was a huge encompassing program, and it was meant to unify. It was a nationalist organization, and it had two primary entities. It was the National Socialist Factory Organization, and then, of course, the Trade and Industry Organization. And within this, you know, the labor contracts actually were largely honored. However, strikes were forbidden. They were absolutely forbidden. They were not going to throw in the primary. There was two primary bases for that, Deanna. One was production. They did not want to halt production because their idea was they wanted to get the economy restored and they wanted to keep people working. They also seized all these Marxist trade unions' bank accounts. They seized them, and they found that if you look at the records at the time, and they seized them via court orders. And when they seized this, bear in mind, this was the Weimar judiciary. They actually went into Weimar courts with the request to seize them. And it was Weimar judges that approved the seizure of these accounts.
Because right,
this was early on.
Right.
When the National Socialists, when this happened, it's important to note, when this happened, the National Socialists were still in a coalition government. But anyway, they actually eliminated the regional and national wage rates, and they paid according to the performance principle. And it was based on output. They did ban the Jews from the organization. That was in accordance with the 1935 decrees. But within this labor front came the Strength Through Joy program, the KDF. And as part of the KDF program came birth of the every worker. Every worker got guaranteed time off, including cruises. There was cruise ships that were funded through, and when they seize these Marxist trade union bank accounts, it's almost like you hear about the fat cat Marxist unions in the United States today, where they're basically hammering these poor workers for dues, and of course the unions are living like fat cat.
Right. And they were peopled with Marxists in the beginning in the 20s or earlier.
So when they created this German labor front, they took those funds and they said the workers are going to benefit this. So when you've seen these cruise ships that every German worker was guaranteed vacation, including cruises to some of these German workers had never been on a cruise up to the Norwegian fjords and to the Mediterranean before. They used it with the funds that these Marxist unions had been basically extorting from these workers for so many years. They also invented the KDF wagon, which, as we saw in the chat room, was the precursor of the Volkswagen, where each worker could pay, I think it was 5 marks a month, into a holding account. They would get a coupon, a stamp, which would go into a booklet. And then when they reached the agreed-upon price, and I can't remember right offhand what the price was, they would turn their coupon book in, and they would get a people's car.
Car, right. All righty, we're going to a 3-minute break. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. Today is Rodney Martin. He is the director of Worldview Foundations. His website is wvfoundations.org. And you were talking about the cars that they could purchase for a relatively inexpensive price and the cruises that they could take. And this is wonderful. I mean, when you look at the unemployment situation in our country right now, and I mean, it's just amazing. Just incredible.
Let's look at what they were doing, and then we'll talk about where people will argue that no, they were completely socialistic, because there was a change in policy, and I want to address that. You know, fair is fair. They were working towards creating one, a folkish community, Germany for Germans. And they actually advocated self-determination for all peoples. Look, what you do in your country is good for you, whatever, but we want Germany for Germans. Also, finally, on the trade union thing, also National Socialists did for workers, and you know what the Marxist trade unions couldn't deliver, and even the Weimar, you know, the Marxist Weimar never done for Germans. You know, they had wanted that traditional Labor Day holiday on May 1st for years and years and years and years. Hitler granted it. He granted it. Weimar had the Marxist-infested Weimar government and the trade unions. They had never given the workers themselves had wanted that Labor Day holiday on May 1st. Hitler granted it in his first the first May Day speech. Hitler said, "Bless now our fight for our freedom, the fight we wage for our German people and fatherland." That was his first. That was the first statement he made on May Day. He granted it, mm-hmm. But at the same time, he was reorganizing and restructuring. The society. He was purging purging the Marxist leftist elements out that had been flourishing under Weimar. So it's pretty clear. You have Trotsky's Trotsky's essay in June of 1933. You have Hitler's interview with a British tabloid newspaper and his statement with the Sudeten Germans. There is a clear distinction between National Socialism and socialism of the left. It's clearly not the same thing. But there was there are some that will say, well, look, you know, what about the four-year plan? What about that? Well, there was clear distinction, because what you had going on internationally was, Germany recovered so rapidly, it shocked the Judeo bankers in London and New York and around the world. This economic model, which, you know, keep in mind, they had marginalized the National Socialist Party during the rise to power. They didn't give it. They thought that actually Hitler wouldn't last, because there'd been a turnover in Weimar chancellors. They didn't think that he would last. But then when they saw the rapid recovery, particularly, you know, and I mentioned in 1933. The unemployment rate went from about almost 5 million down to 2 million. By 1935, Deanna, it was down to 1 million. And by 36, it was almost gone. So in 36 months, I've always said, you know, this was an economic model, an economics alone, that took a country that was in far worse shape than the United States, bear in mind, because the United States in the Depression didn't have the debt on it that Germany was still under obligations,
right, with all the reparations.
That's right. Yeah. Plus Weimar, the Weimar government in 1926, 27, 28 had mortgaged its national railway and all that to create that artificial economic boom. So they had that to deal with as well. But yet they had the National Socialist government had turned it around. They had created by late 1935, early 1936, full employment. And they were then moving ahead. Well, by then you had the, you know, early on in their, within a couple of months of Hitler becoming chancellor, you had the Jews claiming for an international boycott. You had the Jews whispering in Rosenfeld's ear. You had the London Jews going out to work and calling for international trade boycotts and such. And so to respond to that, you had the National Socialists begin their, what would only be called the bartering model. You had them going elsewhere. You had them going down into Southern Europe and then into Latin America, trading, awesome German cars and tractors for, coffee. And so I'm using that as an example because I actually know, I met a young man here in California whose grandfather actually was one of the worked for a German company that actually brokered German agricultural machinery into Bolivia for for products, agricultural products. Coffee was one of them, I believe. But that began to take off, and that really shocked the world, because what do you have missing from that? The Jewish middleman who's marking everything up and making money for nothing. And that became vastly, vastly popular. You know, to his credit, Hugo Chavez took great did that very same thing. He traded Venezuelan oil and such for various products. He engaged in some of that type of bartering transactions. Well, the Germans started doing that as well. And what they were moving towards was complete self-sufficiency. They started developing synthetic materials and such. And that scared the bejesus out of the international Jewish economic system, because if Germany did it, other countries might just start doing it as well. And all of a sudden you'd have this plutocratic banking class out of work. They might have to go out and work for a living. And boy, they did not want to do that. So in 1936, you had the advent of the four-year plan. But we'll pick this up on the other side.
All righty, be right back, and we will take your calls at 800-313-9443. Our guest today is Rodney Martin. He is the director of Worldview Foundations. That website is wvfoundations.org. We will take your calls at 800-313-9443. So far, we don't have any callers. I think people are just so interested in what you're saying that they don't want to interrupt.
Well, let me give you just a couple of statistics here. The original architect in the early part, and I think there's two phases of the National Socialist economy, which was clearly not socialist from the anywhere near socialist from the Marxist terms. But Jalmar Schacht was the initial. He was actually granted by law the Reichstag to be both economics minister and president of the Reichsbank in July of 1934, just about a year after. About six, 7 months after Hitler became, that would have been about a year after Hitler became chancellor. Hitler became chancellor in January 1933, so about a year and a half after Hitler became chancellor, Schacht became both economics minister and president of the Reichsbank. He pursued this policy of signing bilateral trade agreements with other countries, but he targeted both the Balkans and South America, as I said before the break. And this resulted in this what we called swapping agreements, where barter agreements, where you would trade. You know, big one was German machinery for other items and such. But the by 1935, Germany had a trade surplus, and by 1935, the German economy had grown 50%. It's just amazing, just on that, and that again. Demonstrated that just scared the international Jewish bankers to no ends, and then of course you had this outcry. I mean, the international pressure, the Jewish bankers in London and New York were doing their handiwork. I mean, they were really ratcheting up the propaganda against Germany. And then of course in 1936, what I would call the phase two, which was the four-year plan, Hitler had ordered Hermann Göring, made him director plenipotentiary of the four-year plan, which was one of autarky, which was to make Germany self-sufficient. They knew, what is the first thing? We see, it's the same playbook, Deanna. We see this now. They did it to Saddam Hussein. They did it to Libya. You slap sanctions on. You start isolating their ability to engage in trade. So Germany, they were pretty forward-thinking. They did not want to be squeezed out. They did not want to be starved out. That had happened in the First World War, actually. They even kept starving them out for about a year and a half after the war ended, and people, starved to death. So what I would call the phase two of the German economics was Hermann Göring was given wide powers over the economy, over production and over productions and such. However, this is often misinterpreted. Often misinterpreted as saying that the National Socialists took control over the means of production. It is not. It was not. National Socialists did not go into all the German bakeries and say you only make 300 loaves of bread on Wednesday and 200 on the following Monday. That is not what was happening. That was not what was happening at all. They were actually, one, it had more to do with actually armaments production, because there was a commitment. They were rebuilding, they were redeveloping the Luftwaffe at that time, which Hermann Göring was also the air minister as well. Hitler decided to basically trash the Treaty of Versailles, and nobody can blame him. Nobody. I mean, he had fans. I mean, even David Lloyd George, the former prime minister of Britain, agreed with him there that treaty needed to go away. And even the famous architect of Keynesian economics didn't like the Treaty of Versailles and was there arguing against it. So anyway, the four-year plan is often used by proponents that National Socialism was absolute socialism to indicate that the National Socialist government took absolute control of the German economy. It's not true. It had more to do with the war footing, which actually the United States and every other country did as well. Ask Walt Disney when his studio was essentially nationalized and the Singer sewing machine factories.
Absolutely. He was making films for Washington.
Yeah. So anyway, that the four-year plan is often misrepresented as an absolute takeover of the entire German economy. He was given supervision to guide it towards this, what we would call absolute self-sufficiency. And that was where that was the whole aim of National Socialism anyway, to make Germany self-sufficient, they'd never be starved.
Rodney, we do have some callers.
Sure.
So let's go ahead and take some callers. Can I make
one final comment? Also, in 1937, this is important, Schott resigned in 37 and was replaced by Walter Funk, who was a protege of Gottfried Feder, which is important because Gottfried Feder was the architect of getting rid of and removing usury from the German economy, which happened. And this was incredibly important because often people will think, well, why didn't Gottfried Feder have a prominent role? Gottfried Feder was teaching economics in the University of Munich. Walter Funk, his protege, was actually the economics minister in the Third Reich.
Right. And Schott got away scot-free at Nuremberg. But anyway, let's take Richard in Alabama. Richard, welcome to the program.
Hi, Rodney. I got pretty old before I began to realize there were lots of sources of tax revenue in this country that were being left alone and never even mentioned. The profits from transfer pricing and from borrowing money from your foreign subsidiaries, and the rental income collected by foreign landlords, and the property tax revenue being collected by foreign owners of local property tax bonds. And I guess that there's about a dozen other things. I made a long list of things that weren't being taxed in America, and that and the list all added up to where the money was, the real wealth of America is.
Wouldn't it be nice to tax all that stuff and get them out of your pocket?
Yeah.
That's what the Germans, the working man,
and let all of these huge sources of income go unmentioned.
Well, that is you're sounding like a National Socialist. Let's have the country for our people, and let's get the get rid of these and expose these foreign influences. And that's what's happened in the United States, is that the United States has become one big co-op to be co-opted. I say a co-op to be co-opted by foreign influences, and that goes not only for economics but for tax policy, to immigration. You have, you know, plane loads of people that land every day at LAX and New York just to have babies, so they have American citizenship, and then 3 days later get back on the plane to go back to their countries. And that's what the United States has become. It's become a co-op to be co-opted. And the people that live here that call themselves Americans, they pay the tab.
Yeah, we're suckers.
Yeah, well, it's probably worse than that, but I won't use the word on the air. But it's horrific. As a chat room person just said, it's a Judaized culture, And it's kind of funny that Jewish bankers and Jews will do to our country what they will prohibit to be done in their own country. And that's something that we need to talk about, is why do people advocate doing things to our country and our nation that they will absolutely prohibit being done in their country?
Yeah. Exactly. Well, thank you, Richard. Appreciate your phone call. All righty, let's take Werner in New Brunswick. Werner, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Diana, and good afternoon, Mr. Martin.
Hi, Werner.
It's always a learning experience, more and more. And I phoned up there earlier. There seemed to be something with access and the show there this afternoon. I noticed it here. It keeps, when I click on Listen Live Online, it keeps repeating the first part of the show.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting. Did you mention that to the producer?
Yeah, I mentioned it to him. And as I say, with today's technology, anything is possible. And you got so much, and your guests got so much valuable information that should open even the eyes of those that are already half blind, you know?
Right.
And maybe there's some vested interests at work that don't want the facts to cloud their vision, to cloud the vision of the public, so they can keep bamboozling the people even longer.
Well, actually, RBN has not had any other complaints about this, so it might be a local problem. Maybe there's some local electrical harassment up there where you're at.
Well, as I say, I don't want to rule that out. But I want to concur in, about all what your guest was saying. And there's another lie that's been floated around about gun control.
Oh, yes.
You know, and I contacted a fellow of a local gun club. You know, it has been around for over 100 years over there in our town. You know,
mm-hmm.
What I read on the internet and what I heard from my parents and so, those gun clubs, they were not prohibited, and they were holding shooting competition, you know, every year, and every second year they had a big fair, you know, on the commons, and they had basically a big parade through the town. About this, prohibiting gun control, I think that's a bunch of nonsense. They want to lump the National Socialists in together with the Communists, but they talk very little about the real face of the Communists and about nearly 300 million of human casualties in their path in order to establish their Communist paradise.
Indeed. Well, we always appreciate your calls, Werner. You always have something to add.
And as I say, people who are seeking for the truth, you know, they appreciate what you are doing there.
Well,
and,
thank you.
What your guests are doing, and it is not without risk, you know, sticking out the neck, because there are lots of snipers in the background who want to shoot those people, shoot them down, the ones that stick out their neck.
Because okay, having some interference from your local area. Somebody else just mentioned it. So there are certain words that Rodney has brought up today that apparently people in Canada do not want this to get out. So, interesting. Thank you.
As I say, you know, and I don't want to rule out those in the police, Canada's National Police,
mm-hmm.
the Security Service. And we know most of the countries in the world where those government organizations and institutions are being controlled by.
Right. Unfortunately. All righty. Thank you so much, Werner.
You're welcome.
Alrighty, let's take Harold in Texas. Harold, welcome to the program.
Yes, good afternoon, Diana. I write and publish about some similar things as Rodney Martin. And I just wanted to say that it's amazing how that...
Oh, this is Harold. It's not Harold.
Yeah, this is Harold, yes.
Doctor, how are you?
been lucky enough to be a guest on your program before.
Yes.
But I just wanted to say that I essentially consider myself a National Socialist, and it's amazing how that Adolf Hitler and National Socialism have been so demonized and denigrated, and you're doing great service by having a program like this and having Rodney on to correct all these misnomers and ugly things that are said, and to get the truth out. And that's basically just what I wanted to say, that I admire what you're doing. Keep on doing it, please.
Well, Dr. Rome, we also admire what you do and appreciate the work that you do in your books. And thank you so much
for calling. Yes, ma'am.
All righty. Take care. All right. Rodney, your comments about what...
Well, it was Dr. Rome, wasn't it, that just called in?
Yes, yes.
Yes, he's outstanding. He's absolutely correct. And when I was very young, of course, I had the benefit of having German grandparents, German great-grandparents. What just didn't smell right is when you have such a concentrated effort for people to just demonize an individual and a movement and a concept and a worldview so much. There has to be a reason for it, and I would encourage people to really, really look into the reason why. And that was what spurred my interest. And my grandparents originally said, don't take our word for it. Look into it yourself and come to your own conclusions. And it didn't take very much, research on my part to realize that, unfortunately, contrary to popular myth, the good guys don't always win. And that's what happened in World War II. The United States and Great Britain got hoodwinked at being on the wrong side of history. And there were a lot of persons in both Britain and in the United States, that realized it at the time. But they were shouted out and they were demonized and they were marginalized. And it's interesting, there's a plethora of statements. Hitler did not have any negative attitudes against the British people or against the United States. However, he did warn in his unpublished second book that unless the United States threw off its Jewish yokes and dealt with this, the Jewish what we would call Jewish multiculturalism, we would cease to exist. And it's interesting because that's what's happening today. We are ceasing to exist more and more every day. And he warned about it in that second book that was not published. That's widely available today. There was another quote I wanted to bring up. This was a British. I talked about the Time magazine distortions, but there was a British distortion. Hitler gave a speech on his anniversary of the putsch, and this is fascinating. This British publication. It was called Royal Institute of International Affairs, and it was called Bulletin of International News, and it was published on March 8, 1941. And it said that, Hitler gave a speech, and this was, and he basically said that National Socialism and Marxism are the same. Well, here's the problem. You can pull that speech up, and Hitler gave that speech in Munich, and he the buzzwords that they use, and they distorted. Where he talked about the common revolution, he's talking about Italy, not Russia.
Interesting. I'm sorry. There's a comment in the chat room. Some people like to say that they define capitalism as one thing and socialism and communism as something else. A definition that some people apply to fascism is that is where you make money that you get to keep. But if you lose money, all of society is forced to cover the losses. And they would like to hear your view of that opinion when we come back. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today has been Rodney Martin. He is the director of Worldview Foundations. His website is wvfoundations.org. And you mentioned fascism before, but there are people who say that fascism is where if you make money, you get to keep it. But if you lose money, all of society is forced to cover the losses. Your comments on that?
I agree with that. actually, that is modern-day bastardization. That's plutocratic, Judaic hyper-capitalism. That's an abomination. That's not free market. That's not the free market where basically you rise and fall based on your own merit. And that's certainly not what was happening in National Socialist Germany. And I'm not sure that's not even what was happening under Mussolini's Italy. What the comparison, as a matter of fact, go a step further. The National Socialists opposed that very issue. The National Socialists opposed the banks making poor decisions and then coming to the Weimar government and requesting taxpayer bailout, which the Weimar government was doing. And it was so foolhardy because the Weimar government was borrowing money from the United States and mortgaging their railways and then bailing out these foolish business, not only German banks, but either other businesses as well. And National Socialists opposed that. So speaking as, you know, from the National Socialist Party, but the NSDAP opposed and supported. The NSDAP opposed essentially businesses that were making money and paying their executives. In fact, they even said it in the 1928 program, paying their executives huge bonuses and salaries and making bad decisions and then coming to the government for taxpayer bailouts. The National Socialists opposed that. So from a National Socialist point of view, that is not National Socialist. And bear in mind, National Socialism is not fascism. Fascism and National Socialism are two different systems, are two different ideologies. And I think I've talked about that before on your show, Dean. I definitely talked about it on John Friend's show. Fascism in Italy was completely different than National Socialism in Germany. I think here is the problem, and I heard this on another show recently where somebody purported that we have fascism in the United States. I think that's a false statement. I think that's a red herring. I think that's meant to distract people. What we have in the United States is perverted, Judaic, plutocratic, hyper-capitalism, and very much elitism as well. We don't have true free market. Free market economy at all. You have an economy that is so dominated by power Judaic elite that is probably more what I would call a Judaic Marxism. Actually, you almost have Chinese communism here than
right,
anything else.
I think we do.
I think that's where people are confused. I think actually the United States more resembles Chinese communism than anything else. You definitely don't have fascism. And we'd be far better off under National Socialism, where you'd have a nationalist, you'd have nationalism, and you would actually have true free market economy that would be working for the good of a national community, for the nation, and not for a select, you know, foreign influences.
Right. Oh, we've run out of time. That happens.
Okay. It happens. I've enjoyed the show, Dan. I hope this is helpful. I hope we clarified that issue between the two, between National Socialism and Marxism.
Oh, absolutely. It's been wonderful. Thank you so much for being on the program today, Rodney. We'll talk soon. Thank you.
Thank you, Deanna.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye, listeners. Talk with you tomorrow.